And you're both fairly passionate about the topic, and you're discussing, and maybe you throw in a couple facts here or there, and then one of you, whether it's you or the other person, says, well, I read online somewhere that actually your whole point is wrong and what I said is correct. And then you turn to them and it's like, where did you read online? And they're like, well, it was online somewhere. I'm sure I could find it if I just Googled it. This clip explains that feeling to me quite a bit.
Wikipedia is the best thing ever. Anyone in the world can write anything they want about any subject. So you know you are getting the best possible information.
Anyone in the world can write anything about any subject. The best possible information. Our culture today is obsessed with knowing. We love to know. We love to gain facts. We love to play trivia games. And it's just a part of our life. Whether we want to know, different trivias or facts about movies and the actors in them, quotes from your favorite TV shows, who's going to win the election, all the stuff. We just claim to know and we love knowledge. But if we're being honest, most of this knowledge doesn't make much sense in the real world. You know, who the Kardashians are dating aren't going to change how you live your life. If you're stranded on an island, knowing how often the Canucks win when there's a full moon won't help you. Our culture loves to know, and if we don't know something, we whip out our phone and are connected to an endless supply of knowledge. Even a recent study just came out. People under 30 years old read more books than people over 30 years old. That's kind of hard to think, but we do, and that's me, I guess. Yay. So we are even more consumed with knowledge than ever before. It's just a part of our culture. And why am I talking so much about knowing on a sermon about love? It's because John does something interesting in his letter, and especially in this section where he connects the idea of knowing and the idea of love so closely together. And so this morning, the big idea is that when we know the God of love, we cannot help but to be transformed. And there's three questions up on the screen here that we're going to walk through. You know, what does it mean to know? Who do we know? And what does knowing look like? So let's just jump right in. The first one, what does it mean to know? First two verses, 7 and 8. Dear friends, let us love one another. Just let's pause there for a second. Two things I want to point out. When John is writing this, he's writing it to a specific community of believers. When he's saying dear friends, it's could also be translated as dearly beloved. You know, you are my brothers and sisters. He's writing it to a specific group of people who follow the faith, follow the way that John follows. The second thing, that let us love one another, is actually a bookend of the beginning and the end of this train of thought. And the rest of John 4, 1 John 4, actually is pretty much an exposition of this paragraph. And so John begins and ends this thought with the idea of loving, this actionable item of loving one another. And we're going to come back to both of those things at the end, but just keep them in mind. So let's carry on. Let us love one another, for love comes from God. Everyone who loves has been born of God and knows God. Whoever does not love does not know God, because God is love. Just like in our culture today, being obsessed with knowledge, the culture in which John spoke to, the Greco-Roman world, they loved and valued knowing. The story that comes to my mind is when Paul goes to Athens. Right, and Paul walks in to Athens. There's a bunch of gods around. There's a nameless god. And he's there with all the religious and philosophical thinkers of the day in Athens. And he starts talking about the God of the Bible. And they have the most interesting response for Paul. They say this, may we know what this new teaching that you are presenting? For you bring something strange to our ears. We wish to know, therefore, what these things mean. They wanted to know. They wanted to gain knowledge. And I don't think they cared about how they lived. They were just wanting to know. And one of the main reasons that John is writing this letter to a group of believers is because that there was people in the community who claimed to know something other than what John and the other apostles had taught about Jesus. And this is key. It shows up in the entire letter that these people are claiming to know something contrary. And this is just me speculating, so I'll step away from the Bible. I don't think that these people who claim to know something different than what all their teachers knew, I don't think they woke up one day and be like, huh, you know what, I'm going to just believe something completely different. You know, they didn't just flip on a switch and completely change what they believed. I bet it was more about them getting consumed with periphery ideas, you know, ideas that were maybe non-essential and just focusing on that. You know, this idea of a slow movement, of a drift away from the core. And this is what's happening in John's day. They were focusing on things that were less essential than what John and the other apostles had taught. And John goes on to describe these people in the second chapter. He says, they went out from us, but they were not of us. For if they had been of us, they would have continued with us. That's kind of a tongue twister, with us. Essentially, what John is saying is that it's a group of believers, and if they would have believed what we believed, they would still be around. But they didn't. They were disruptive in this community. They were calling people out. They were doing all these things. And what were these areas that they believed that were contrary to what John and the other apostles taught about Jesus? Some people much smarter than me have compiled a list. And so here are a few of the main ones. The first one is that these people did not believe that Jesus is the Son of God. It will show up on screen here. Jesus is the Son of God, or the way to God the Father. If you want to check what I'm saying, the verses are up there. I don't have time to run through them all today. But essentially, the core fundamental truth about Christianity, which focuses on Jesus as the fulcrum of the entire gospel story, right? From creation to consummation, Jesus, they decided to move away from it. They stopped believing that Jesus was the Son of God, and he's the way to God the Father. They didn't believe that. And so they would say things like, we know Jesus. He's even a part of our faith. He's a great example of what it means to love one another. But he's not actually God's anointed Messiah saving us from our sins. That's not Jesus. And the interesting thing is that when these people removed the core belief of who Jesus is, other things started to shift as well. And so they started to not take sin seriously. And logically, this actually makes sense, right? If you don't believe that Jesus is the God made flesh who suffered and died for our sins and was sent to the cross, you know, if you don't believe that Jesus did all that, what motivation do you have to take the things seriously that sent Jesus to the cross? If Jesus wasn't who he said he was, if Jesus didn't endure all that to go to the cross, there's no reason to care about what sent him to the cross. And so they did not take sin seriously. You know, and another one is that they were just satisfied with intellectual assent instead of obedience. There's a group of people who paid lip service to God without actually living a transformed life. And it comes back to this idea of when you remove Jesus from the core and center of the faith, everything else moves. Because an encounter with Jesus will not leave you the same way as when you first met him. There's going to be a transformation. And so these people were just satisfied with intellectual consent or assent instead of obedience. There was no distinction between living and knowing, right? They were satisfied with just having just knowing the right thoughts, knowing the correct doctrine. The scary thing is that I read these things and I see these things about the people in John's day. And I see them in my own life at times, of how I stopped taking sin seriously of how I'm satisfied to know rightly, and I know a lot of things. You read a lot of books, you go to school, and so I know what's right. And yet, does my life reflect that? A lot of stuff is lost when Jesus isn't the focus of the faith. And John here, he says, everyone who loves God has been born of God and knows God. Whoever does not love does not know God. He draws this incredible line between knowledge and love. And a culture so obsessed with knowledge, just like their culture is, John actually wants people to have a different definition of what it means to know. He doesn't want you to just know intellectually. He wants you to know deep down in your gut, a deep residing knowledge that actually can only come with experience, with an intimate firsthand experience. You know, he doesn't want you to just know. He wants you to know. And John is speaking to a group of people. He reminds them of a word that they would have known, and it's throughout the entire Old Testament. It's the Greek word yada. I'm pretty sure Pastor Keith has spoken about this before, but the Greek word yada is translated to know. You have an example in the book of Genesis. Adam knew Eve. Adam yada Eve. That's not intellectual assent, right? That was a joke, but okay. That is a deep, intimate knowing rooted in relationship. Psalm 139, Lord, search me and know me. Lord, search me and yada me. There's a difference between knowing and knowing. And John proposes that knowing is actually an ongoing experience rooted in relationship. It's an ongoing experience rooted in relationship. There's a painting, it'll show up on screen here. You might recognize it. It's the Prodigal Son painting by Rembrandt. I believe it was painted in the late 1600s, 1667, 69, near the final years of Rembrandt's life. Pretty cool painting, right? Even if you're not a fan of art, I think we can appreciate this. It's neat to see how the prodigal son broke in, coming before and embracing dad. I imagine that's the older son off to the side. There's some people in the background. And like, I can appreciate this painting. I can even like this painting, maybe love this painting if I look at it long enough. That's how art works, right? If you look at something long enough, you start to love it. My dad loves this painting. He loves it so much. And I will actually just never love it as much as him. And I wonder why. And so I gave him a call one day this week. And I was like, yo, dad, what's the deal about this prodigal son painting? And you know what? Instantly, he started listing off these things about how he loved the father. Actually, one of his hands is painted in a more feminine way. And it's the idea that Rembrandt wants to draw the viewer into a fuller experience of God. That's a full characteristic. It's reminiscent of a verse in Isaiah where God says, as a mother comforts her child, so I will comfort you. And then my dad started to tell me the story about the prodigal son, about how in a sketch of the same painting done a few years earlier, actually showed the prodigal son in a less desolate state. The son in the sketch still had some muscles on him. He still had some composure about him. He did not look nearly as broken as he does in this painting. And my dad started to tell me, as Rembrandt went through his life and experienced sin and brokenness, the painting actually changed and it paralleled. He, Rembrandt, saw himself in the prodigal son, and as he went further and further into brokenness, so the painting went further and further into brokenness. It's an idea that he was utterly broken before a God who is loving and merciful. There is a difference between knowing and knowing. I can love this piece of art. I can appreciate it for what it is, but until I get to know the artist and his intentions behind every stroke, the story behind the art, I will not love the art like my dad does. How similar is this to God? The master artist, creating a canvas of love. Everyone, doesn't matter if you're in this church, outside of the church, Christian or not, everyone can experience love, receive love, and give love. But we will never truly know the full expression of what it means to love, of what it means to be loved, unless we know the God, the artist, and the intention behind every stroke, the story behind love. Unless we know the God who is love, we will actually never fully experience love. There is a difference between knowing and knowing. And John is drawing us into this idea, hey, knowing isn't just head stuff. Knowing is this ongoing experience that's rooted in relationship with a God who loves. And so who do we know? It's God, right? And John says simply, one of the most profound statements, God is love. God is love. A couple weeks ago, Pastor Keith actually unpacked the Greek word behind this in a different chapter in 1 John. The Greek word we're familiar with if we come to church is agape. And agape love is quite different than conditional love. Conditional love moves from emotion to will. You know, it says, I feel love, therefore I will love. I feel love, therefore I will love. Agape love is quite the opposite. The love that's used to describe who God is, it says, I will love you, therefore I feel love. It moves from will to emotion. John does not say God is loving. Even though he is, God is loving. John says God is love. Describes who he is. Not a characteristic, but his essence, his being. No one in this room, even my friends, would say that Brendan, especially my friends, would say that Brendan is love. Right? You wouldn't say that. You might say I am loving, but you'd probably preface that comment even with, Brendan, if I get Brendan a cup of coffee in the morning, he is loving. Love between us, between humans, actually, it tends to be awakened by something in the beloved. Love tends to be awakened by something in the one being loved. You know, it's that look when you catch their eye and their eyes light up and something just spurs in you. Oh, it's awakened in the beloved. On the other hand, the love of God is free. It's spontaneous. It's uncaused. It's unevoked. It's unconditional. It's agape love. And Paul would even say that while we were not lovely creatures, right? I think we can admit to ourselves when we're alone with our thoughts, sometimes we're like, oh, I'm not the most lovely creature. I'm not even the most deserving of love. Paul would say in Romans that while we were in active rebellion against God, that is when he showed his ultimate love for us. Oh, how incredible. This love that John speaks about actually doesn't stay in the abstract for too long, right? Because the agape love of God cannot be removed from how God shows us his love. And he shows us his love in his son, Jesus. And that's what these next verses are about, 9 and 10, right? This is how God showed his love among us. He sent his one and only son into the world that we might live through him. This is love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his son as an atoning sacrifice for our sins. God's love is shown in him sending his son Jesus into the world so that we may be rescued from our sins. You know, this is the God we are invited to know, to experience, to be intimately familiar with. The God who dwelt in our world, who suffered and died on our behalf, who rose again from death to life so that we too may have life. This is God and this is his love. And the crazy thing, people in John's community had moved past this fundamental truth of who God is and how God shows us who he is in Jesus. They moved past from Jesus and the cross. And I don't know why, but we do the same thing too. We move past from the cross. We move on to bigger and better things as if there is something bigger and better than how God has shown us his love for us at the cross. We never move on from the cross. We only move further into a deeper understanding of it. You know, the cross and its meaning aren't something we ever master. It's the God who is love, sending his son as an ultimate act of showing his love for you. This is love for you when you're at your worst. This is love for you when you think yourself unlovable. This is love for you that calls you to stop looking at yourself. Stop trying to build yourself up. Stop trying to prove yourself to be something. Stop trying. This is love for you that says stop. Stop with the running. Stop with the comparisons. Stop with the incessant trying. And just rest. Rest in the unevoked, uncaused, free, spontaneous love of God. We get so caught up in lists, in action items, in ways of self-improvement. I don't know why, but we think that actually having three ways to love one another will help us love one another. When we move past the center and the core of what love is, shown in Jesus, if we move past that, we will never get to the loving others as God loved us. He is calling us to enter into a relational knowledge that's only found in that intimate experience. You know, this crazy thing happens when we experience and know God. Is that we're not left the same. We are transformed, quite literally. And it leads us to kind of the final question. What does knowing look like? It's two verses. Dear friends, since God so loved us, we also ought to love one another. Remember that bookend. It's the bookend there. No one has ever seen God, but if we love one another, God lives in us and his love is made complete in us. If our lives are not marked by loving each other, I think the question begs to be asked, do we truly know the God who is love? And so there's a question I want us to think about today. It's incredibly practical and quite scary if we're honest with ourselves. It's this: how do I interact with others? How do you interact with others? Is it marked by convenience and exclusiveness? Or is it marked by self-sacrifice and inclusiveness? Am I only loving people when it's easy for me? Am I only loving people when they come to me? Do I only love the people around me? These are tough questions. I have a story to share as I close, and the band can come up. And this story is about a guy. I moved from Winnipeg to Southern Alberta Bible Camp, just north of Lethbridge, about 3 years ago. Okay, 3 years ago, I went from Winnipeg to Lethbridge, and I made the big move, and I remember rolling into camp. There's about a dozen full-time staff who lived on site, and four of them had families. One of the guys, his name was John, John Keller, not to be confused with John the Apostle, but John was a cool guy. And as soon as I met him, as soon as I saw him and kind of interacted with him a little bit, I saw how much he loved his family. right? If I was kind of working with him a little bit, or if he was doing something, and he got a call from one of his kids, he would instantly drop everything, go hang out with this kid. He had five kids. The two of them, the youngest, were twins, and they were about 3 years old when I met him. And John just loved, he doted on his family. It's not like he wasn't a hard worker. He was an incredibly hard worker, but he was a hard worker at work and also at home with his kids and his wife. And I just remember him time and time again going out of his way to show love to his family. And it was so cool. We would eat around the table, and one of his little kids would come up, and right in the middle of a conversation, he would just drop whoever he's talking to and just pick up the kid on his, sit him on his lap. Like, that's just neat. One of the first conversations I had with John is I met him, and John looks at me and he's like, "Brendan, anytime you need anything, ever, you give me a shout. I will be there. If you need help building something, putting something together, I'll be there. If you need help with your car, I will be there. If you just need to get away from camp and hang out with me at my home and eat food, I will be there. I'll be there." Or for him, if you just want to go shoot some guns, I'll be there, because John is a redneck. John was so loving with his family in such an incredible way, but he was so inviting on who was in his family. I showed up and I rolled into camp, and as soon as I had that conversation, I knew he meant every single word he said, and I was like one of his. It was the coolest thing, and he proved it to me time and time again. I needed a new car, and so I was like, "John, do you mind like spending 4 or 5 hours with me in the city one night?" And John has a family with five kids. He works way more than he should. I said, "Yeah, Brendan, I'll be there." And he rolled with me into town and helped me find a car. I was like, John just loved me continually. And I would go back to him and he would ask me how my heart's doing. Church, imagine if we loved our family like John loved his family. Imagine if we loved the brothers and sisters that you're sitting next to in the way that John loved his family. Where one of us is in need, we will drop everything to go be with them. When one of us is mourning, we will go there, we will cry with them. When one of us passes an exam, we will go to Boston Pizza, buy them a pizza. And more than that, when people come through our door, we love them like one of our own, because they are. That love is so attractive to people outside of the family and people within, because that love is self-sacrificial. It is inclusive. And isn't it how Jesus has loved us? And the ultimate act of self-sacrifice, God sent his son so that we may be included in his family. Oh, that's good news. That is incredible that Jesus would do that. There is a difference between knowing and knowing. And when we truly know the God who is love, we cannot help but be stirred into love for one another. Because when we know the God who would give everything so that we may be included as one of his own, that's going to stir something in us. And this morning, we're going to enter into a time of response, a time of singing God's love for us and declaring our love for God. Maybe this morning, Jesus is just calling you to stop caring about those peripheral thoughts and ideas and just focus on him. Hey, come back to your first love. Maybe your life is marked by exclusiveness and convenience. Hey, just come back to me. Come back to Jesus. Maybe you've ignored sin in your life for too long. Come back. Jesus is calling us to come back, because when we experience him, when we know him, our lives are going to be transformed into love. there's going to be a time in this first song. There's a space, and even throughout it, that if you find yourself maybe twiddling your thumbs, I want you to turn your eyes towards Jesus and just ask him a question. Jesus, how do you love me? Maybe in that moment, you're going to be reminded of a Bible passage or a hymn you used to sing growing up or this picture of your father reaching out. I don't know what it is. But I trust and know that when we ask Jesus a question like, how do you love me? He will not stay silent. And maybe you're not thinking of anything. Open up 1 John. See how he has loved you. See how he has loved you.